Hello, everyone, and welcome to the In Defense of Plants podcast, the official podcast of indefenseofplants.com. How's everyone doing this week? This is Matt, your host, and welcome to the show. We have a new video up on YouTube, youtube.com/indefenseofplants. In this episode, we go in search of a tiny parasitic orchid known as the autumn coral root. Will we find it? I don't know. You gotta check out the video to make sure. Along the way, we see a lot of cool plants, and we're featuring music by Polish band Ampacity. It's a fun video, so go check that out. All right, what do I have for you today? Actually, I'm very excited about this conversation. He has been called the plant messiah. Joining us from the Royal Botanical Gardens at Kew is Carlos Magdalena. Now, he was responsible for a lot of propagation, but he's been made most famous by bringing plants like the Café Marron back from the brink of extinction. And we'll talk a little bit about that, as well as plenty of other things plant-related. I must warn you, though, our connection was a little rough. So some of the stuff might be a little bit hard to hear and understand. I apologize, but literally nothing I could do at that point. Regardless, it's a fun conversation, and I can't wait to get to it. But first, a few orders of business to take care of. If you're enjoying this podcast and you'd like to support it, please head on over to patreon.com/indefenseofplants and see what we got going on over there. For a little bit of money each month, you can get yourself kickbacks like stickers, access to the VIP section of the indefenseofplants.com website, and for those of you looking to give just a little bit more, you can even get yourself a producer credit on this show. For instance, today's episode is produced in part by Alan, Clifton, Katharina, Shane, Amy, Caitlin, Rosanna, Mary Jane, Manuel, Jennifer, Sarah, Sienna and Garth, Troy, Margie, Laura, and Mark. So thank you to everyone who has given thus far. It really does mean the world to me. If monthly donations are not your thing, we have a donate button on our website, indefenseofplants.com. Just scroll down and you'll see it on the right-hand page. You can give a one-time donation. Money helps. It goes a long way for web hosting, podcast hosting, and other fees associated with this. Podcasting gets a little expensive from month to month, so you are helping a lot by giving a little. If money isn't your thing, which I also completely understand, please head on over to wherever you downloaded this podcast and give it a review and make sure to hit subscribe. Podcatchers use your reviews to make recommendations to other listeners. So if you want to help In Defense of Plants and curing plant blindness across the globe, give it a review and let people know what you think. All I ask is that you're tactful. Question show should be coming up in a little bit. I've gotten enough questions so far, so thank you to everyone who submitted. They are great questions and I'm really excited to answer them. I think everyone's going to enjoy some of these inquiries. I really appreciate it. All right, that's enough out of me. Let's head on over to my conversation with Carlos. I hope you enjoy. Carlos Magdalena, it's an honor to have you on the podcast. How about you tell us a little bit about who you are and what it is you do?
Well, you say my name, and then I work in the Royal Botanic Gardens Kew, mostly on tropical collections. I'm from Spain. I've been working a few 16 years. One of the main interests of mine are propagation and also thereafter conservation. And then plants maybe are one of the most forgotten things. I don't know if I am missing something. I am sure I am. But you may be able to extract it from me.
Okay, wonderful. So has it always been about plants for you, or is this something you kind of came to later in your professional career?
Well, it's hard to say, you see, because the thing is plants were all over the place around me when I was born, because, you know, I come from a very green part of the world, which is northwest Spain. It's one of the temperate rainforests of the world.
Oh,
well, if it wasn't because most of it has been logged, but still in the mountains, there is good examples of it. And then, you know, my grandparents were farmers for mother's side. My mother was a florist. The house was absolutely packed with plants. We have a Spanish property too. So, you know, I think the things that escaped from me were animals, and that's why I was attracted to them, because they were elusive. But I was always looking at some living thing, be it in the rocky pools by the coast, because I live near the beach, or be it my aquarium fish at home, or be it the flying swifts through the window. I don't know where. I have had more things like fevers, if you like.
Yeah.
I have the fish fever, and then I may have the plum fever, and maybe I will have the water lily fever, and then I may have the butterfly moment. And then you, when you're a kid, you can absorb the stuff like a sponge, really. So, and then sometimes later on, years later, you come back to this and then you stand on it. And plants somehow have been always present. And then I think that for work reasons, they are probably the best, you know. You don't have the same emotional attachment that you have to animals. You don't have it so much to the individual, you have it more to the species. So for you can always be collecting all these species and keep them going forever, isn't it? In a way. But then I guess that, you know, for example, in Kew, we grow 80,000 types of plants. They will have 80,000 accessions, not the species. There will be a few less species. And I don't know of any zoo which could keep as many living beings as a botanic garden, you know what I mean, the scale of it. So for that kind of natural science collector thing, plants are exactly what you want to go for.
Wonderful. And I like that you mentioned that fever, because I think a lot of listeners can relate to that, is just becoming completely obsessed with something and, you know, absorbing it like a sponge, as you say. Working with plants can be very convenient at times. Has it always been about propagation and conservation with you, or did you kind of come to that as you started working with plants more and, like you said, realizing that they're often forgotten by most people?
Well, I guess that it goes totally related to, if you want the plant, you need to propagate it, isn't it? And if you want to keep it going in the long term, you need to propagate it too, most of the time. Obviously, there is the specimen value, you know, it's not the same as 700-year-old oak and an acorn. In that case, the specimen is what is most valuable, but at the end of the day, I don't think you can conceive much this horticultural idea without the propagation. It's one of the central elements to it, isn't it? You get a plant and then you chop it into 20 pieces and then you get 20 plants. How amazing is that? You don't get that with your average cat.
Yeah. No, that's a good point. It's inevitable in that field.
Yes, and then you can share them with people and other places. There is always another plant. You know, related to this thing of the fever, if you don't have a fever for any subject at the moment, then you are clearly doing something wrong. And you may want to check it out. Obviously, you cannot get carried away and then just focusing on things. But, you know, they usually always having some interest in the back of your head, that whenever you have a moment or whenever you have a chance, you can always get in seriously, because, you know, 400,000 types of plants, species. And it's not like a fashion either, you know, it's not like you lose your interest. It's like you get to a threshold in where you perhaps, for you to gain more knowledge, you may need to wait time until things get published or more discoveries get made, or you have access to another source of information. And obviously, when you don't get fed with either new plants or new info or something, you have no choice but plant it in the side, and obviously some other subject will kind of trigger your interest.
Yeah. And that's great. I mean, as exciting as it can be, and like you said, there's always something new around the corner, and it's collaborative effort, but patience is a virtue with plants, and you kind of learn to take things at a time scale that's very different than most humans are used to dealing with.
Yes. Gardeners, they go and they sow 300 types of seeds, and then, you know, some of them germinate in 3 days, some of them germinate in 2 months, some of them germinate in a week, and then you have all these fireworks coming every day. Which, in a way, you know, you have to be patient in your patience when you want one specific plant to do something. But when you have a huge collection or a nice garden at home or kind of like the facilities to grow many different things, there is always something happening. there is always some surprises. So at the end of the day, you know, you get all this action happening too, no?
Yeah, no, that's a perfect point, and that's why I just surround myself with plants in every way and shape and possible a combination, because it's just, like you said, it's always something new, there's always a new challenge around the corner.
Something which I love of this subject is that if somebody tells you that they know everything about plants, you know straight away that he's a liar.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't think I've met someone that said that yet, but I would definitely look at them very suspiciously and probably take them too seriously.
No, and you see, there is no shame on it. Actually, it's the beauty of it, that you never know, not even, you know, you will be an amazing, knowledgeable person if you manage to meet the tip of the iceberg, isn't it?
Right. Yeah, and it's for someone that thirsts for knowledge. I mean, plants are always going to have a mystery to solve and something new around the corner to work with, and that's another beauty of a position like yours, and especially in a place like Kew. I would assume that the challenges you face day to day, or at least the mental stimulation you get, is just endless there. So tell us a little bit about what it is you do at Kew for the gardens itself.
Well, I mean, my main role is to work in horticulture, so I grow directly with the plants, and I grow them in the tropical nursery, which is not open to the public. It's not like we are a secret bunker somewhere in the garden, but it's like you can not just walk home and just go and see it. You can visit it with appointment if you're somebody from the science or the media or somebody which has a reason to do, you could go and see it. But then, in there we keep collections of frost tender plants, and we have about 15,000 to 18,000 types of tropical plants and things like this. But my main focus is tropical plants, mostly woody, herbaceous, and aquatic plants. So basically, pretty much any kind of tropical plant which is not a succulent or an orchid. Over the years, you get to work in many different places, but for the last decade or so, I've been just mostly with tropical plants.
Wonderful.
One of the reasons is why tropical plants? Well, there is not many places in Europe where I can work on them. So, through gardens, maybe that's one thing you want to go for. And then second, you just talk about patterns. Well, with tropicals, you need less of that, You hardly need to ever have to wait until next year, Mm-hmm. And then, because I grow them in the nursery, then I grow them in pots, which means I can move them. So I can see the reactions of the plants, Like sometimes I get a plant out of the sun, and then between 5 minutes it's wilting because the change of humidity. So I get a reaction much quickly that when you have a plant outside in the ground, and you cannot do much about it, to be honest, but I can increase the shading, I can increase the temperature, make it in a cooler position, bring them into a maybe close air where it has more humidity, and then you always see the reactions of the plants quite quickly, which I quite like.
Yeah, no, that's a really interesting perspective that I tropics are always doing stuff at a faster rate just because, you add that much more heat and humidity, things are going to speed up metabolically. But again, if you want to see how a plant's responding, moving it from one place in the soil is a lot different than, like you said, picking up a pot and being able to experiment with different scenarios much quicker. And I'm sure that working in a tropical house during the dreary months of winter is another perk.
Well, there's another thing, what I mean?
Yeah.
I guess that when the things get really tough, maybe the stuff in horticulture, the computer work and stuff outside, but then there is all these days which is not clear if it's terrible or bad, and then you end up working outside. And the thing is, in England, for like something like 3 months, besides the snowdrops, you hardly get any action outside. Mm-hmm. Based on the plants, you have a lot of work to do, because it's put into dormancy, and then I hate it. I hate that thing of like having to be there looking at these things doing nothing for 3 months. Where in the tropical nursery, there is always something happens. You see, in January, I germinate the Victoria Amazonica for the summer.
Wow.
So that keeps me nice and warm, and my hands go 32 degrees because it's the temperature of the water. So, I can complain either way.
So working with tropical plants, I mean, like you said, you pretty much exclude everything but the you include everything but the succulents. Now, that's a lot of diversity, right? And every plant is going to have its own subtle nuances. So, a window into your process as a propagator, I mean, what is your process like when you get a new plant or a new set of seeds to work with? I mean, I would assume there's a lot of research, there's a lot of asking around with others that have had experience with these groups. It's a little different each time.
Well, it's very funny because that's the case sometimes, but sometimes there is no case for it. Here comes somebody from Africa with a bag of seeds, label as species, and then what do you do with them? You know what I mean? You don't even know what they are. And he goes like, oh, I recognize a new species, but they haven't worked out yet the genera or the family. And you go like, oh, okay. So you have to then... start doing the Agatha Christie bit. You know, start trying to guess what you do now, no? Mm-hmm. So, it's difficult to explain exactly what they will do without having the case in front of you, you know, because sometimes you can deduct things, like, you know, big seeds or small seeds may indicate one thing or another, or it will indicate that you can, for example, a seed which is like dust, you cannot recover it back mm-hmm. from the compost. Right. And change the compost, not you. Or you will spend 3 weeks doing so. But for example, a kind of large palm seed, like a coco de mer or something like that, you right. can always take it out and change it to environment, and that wouldn't be a big problem. So without a particular case, it's difficult to say. But there is things that you can work out, you know, like for example, there are many different types of seeds, and then they are classified in many different aspects. Like, for example, there could be a classification which could be if the seed is recalcitrant, meaning that cannot be dry, or the seed is orthodox, which means that it can be dry. And what's more, in many cases, it needs to be dry before being sown.
Right.
So, for example, in that case, the seed is not tiny, and usually tiny seeds are not recalcitrant because when they are small, they can dry very quickly, and then usually that wouldn't be the case, with maybe the exception of some aquatic plants, which the seed means to be in the water all the time. So, if that is the case, you may want not to dry the seed, because if you dry it, you kill it, where if it needs to be dry, you can try to germinate it in wet, and then later on, if it doesn't work in a few months, you could try business of drying.
It's like this detective work, right? You're just kind of sleuthing your way through based on experience and, you know, like you said, what's the seeds looking like? Where are they coming from?
A little bit, yeah. And with cuttings or plants which are sick, sometimes it's the same. You know, one thing is, I always compare it to the hospitals. One thing is a GP practice and the specialist person, which obviously knows the cases and has the tools to do the stuff. And another thing is A&E, isn't it? So seeds of unknown things is a bit like the emergency ward. Something comes through the door, deal with it. And then you try to avoid the obvious and react to the things you are watching rather than investigating further.
Right.
You know, because you cannot have, when you work in A&E and you are sick or you need being with you quite quickly, you may not have time to do all the research. You know, if it's a recalcitrant seed and it has arrived to you in a paper envelope and it's already drying, you know, you need to take a decision almost straight away, tomorrow, maybe too late. If that makes sense?
Yeah, no, that's completely, it's exciting, you know, to think about what, you know, who could come in with what, especially at a place like Kew where there's people taking stuff, you know, you're getting shipments of seeds and material from all over the world. And there's got to be an element for someone in your position of a little bit of pressure, because some of the plants you get are very sensitive and maybe not necessarily numerous or possibly even on the verge of extinction in the wild. Is it? Do you ever feel nervous?
yeah. Sometimes I do. Pressure is not good. But then, because you know, sometimes you may get some seeds which is your chance in the decade, or perhaps in your lifetime of getting that seed, you may not get it again.
Yeah.
That is another thing that you have to take in consideration too. You know, how much seed you have.
Right.
Because if you have, for example, a whole bucket of them, the first thing you may do is maybe get a hammer out and boom, smash one, and see how does the thing look. You know what I mean?
Right.
Because you will know, like, oh yes, they are alive. You know, the seed coat is very hard, or, you know, you can waste a few. And then you can do random trials.
Mm-hmm.
So you can go and put, like, you know, let's put 10 in this pot, in this compost, in this way, let's dry 10, let's make, you know, straight away. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, that even if you waste 50 seeds in 10 different trials of 5 seeds each, you have still another 450. It's good to play with. But the problem is, very often you just have only 1 or 2 seeds. And then I guess that you will try to go always in a conservative way, you know. Mm. Like, for example, if it's a rather large seed and I only have one, rather than drying it, I may put in a compost and then try to see if it germinates that way. If it doesn't, then, you know, obviously, kind of common plants, there is a protocol online at the click of a finger in your phone or in your computer in no minute. So you don't need to sometimes reinvent the wheel when there is something published. But very often, you know, that's the case. There is nothing bullish. And then, you see, sometimes you can go like, for example, oh, this is in this family. So this family generally, yeah, that's true. But sometimes families are just like crazy, you know, like, for example, just take water lilies. You know, hardy water lilies, the seed cannot be dry, it has to be always moist, and they need very cold water for a few months or weeks before they germinate when the temperature raises up.
Right.
Victoria Masonica, pretty much the same, but then you need to chill it to stop it from germinating. But then you cannot chill it below 15 degrees because you make it.
Oh, wow.
But then, Australian, African water lilies, most of the tropicals in the subgenus Brachyqueras, you can dry them, but you don't have to. So you could sort them straight away. But then the Australian species, then on those, some of them, you need to dry them and quite hard before getting them to germinate. Some other ones, if you dry them, you may not have killed them, but you may have sent them in dormancy, and maybe only one of 100 will germinate at a time.
Wow.
So you see, oh, it's a water lily, means nothing, unless you have more kinds of concise information regarding the environment and regarding the kind of sub-taxonomical group it belongs to, what subgenera, or maybe what is the most relative species to it.
Huh.
And then after, there is all these things which are more related to the practicalities of sowing the seeds. So, for example, in the case of the hardy water lilies, there is no escape to the fact that they are going to be wet, which means that they are going to be sticky, which means that then you have to handle one seed at a time with tweezers, because you cannot scatter them. But with the African species or some of the Australian ones, you may actually want to dry it. So you want to sow maybe 50 seeds, like by scattering on the top of a surface, which you cannot do when they are wet.
So, it's a tricky process at times.
Sometimes it is. And I find it very amazing. I always say that I want to make a TV program about propagation of plants, but kind of like in the cooking programs style.
Yeah.
So you are in the kitchen with the chopping board, and then, you know, you go doing this and you go doing that, because it's a little bit like cooking.
Right.
You know, you can possibly do things in different ways, but, you know, the final result is not going to be exactly the same. Like, you can make an omelette by, you know, smashing two eggs into a frying pan with the shells and all, and it may be probably edible. It's going to be the finest omelette, isn't it? And actually, it's much easier to crack the egg inside of the board in the kitchen, and then, you know.
Yeah.
But then after, it depends, you know, what compost do you have, what pot do you have, what frying pan do you have, and what stuff do you have. You know, and then you will have to adjust a little bit your kind of recipe, depending on the conditions and the materials you have and the situation you are with.
Yeah. No, I really like that analogy because, you know, someone like me used to get very nervous walking into a kitchen. And then you realize, oh, wow, you know, there's many different ways to do this. And the end result, like you said, can be roughly the same. And the same thing I feel like goes for gardening. You hear a lot of people asking for advice, and there's general rules that apply. But at the end of the day, you know, the success is measured by the growth of a plant, and whether you did that through scarification or through rubbing. You know, you get results, and that's really what matters. And understanding that everyone's going to have different resources available to them, and there's no, you know, one single recipe, so to speak.
No. And then there's different approaches for different reasons. You know, like, for example, in the commercial industry, you know, a 10% more germination, it will mean quite a few bucks at the end of the season.
Mm-hmm.
So that is important. But for you, when you actually want one plant that you have 100 seeds, 10% germination, it will be totally irrelevant, isn't it?
Right.
You're going to end up with plenty of plants giving away and throwing in the bin. Because at the end of the day, you only need one.
Right.
So you may want to do what is the fastest, cheapest way of getting these to bloom. The easiest or the fastest, whatever. So, and then you see also for us, there is another side to this, you know, like I work in Kew and we have all these the materials and resources and it's fine, but then you travel to places like Mauritius or even more remote, Rodriguez Island, where there is hardly any horticultural supply.
Mm-hmm.
Soil cannot be imported, compost has to be invented from the resources on the island. And there is hardly, for example, any compost free of weeds that you can find.
Hmm.
So in that situation, you have to reinvent the wheel. try to come up with a way to, in which maybe it's not the best, but at least it does it.
Yeah, I've really gained an appreciation for that over the last few years, is just being a lot of times money. You just simply can't afford the best of the best equipment and materials, and you just have to adapt. But, you know, in a situation like with Café Moron, for instance, where this plant was discovered, there's only a few, if maybe one or two individuals in the wild. I mean, how does someone like you go about even getting seeds off of a plant that might not even be self-compatible, let alone getting from, you know, ripening those seeds and then germinating them? Just the thought of the pressure of it is interesting, but also just the strategies needed to kind of circumvent these biological conditions that work when there's a lot of plants, but don't work really well when they've been reduced to, you know, pretty much the brink of extinction.
Well, in Tadua, Tadua was a funny example, you know, because in theory, it shouldn't have happened, but then it did. And that was the main key research element in there was obsession. If you know what I mean, is because you will find all these end of the roads, there has to be a way.
Yeah.
If you know what I mean, in that case. In other cases, sometimes you can guess theories and come up with it and then set up experiments to try to prove you're right or wrong. But in the case of Ramos Maria, it was much more about like this obsession with this plant, you know, like I can feel the force. Yeah, kind of like something is telling me there is something missing in here and maybe I may manage to find it. Because if you don't have time, you are never going to get in there.
Right.
Yeah. And I guess that it wasn't only in this plant, only because the seed, you know, like there was only one. And automatically you have all this coil of apocalyptic doomers coming with like, where is the point of trying to do this? Because when there is only one plant, there is not variability, blah, blah, blah. but then there was somebody which went like, no, we won't let this plant go. Kind of like, it's a bit like Bohemian Rhapsody, isn't it? We will not let you go. And then somebody which was working in conservation in Rodriguez Island in the 80s goes and gets a cutting and goes to the airport and talks to a guy which flies a small plane to Mauritius, and then he flies in the cockpit and goes and passes on the tweak to a British Airways pilot, and then he comes to Kew, and then somebody from Kew goes on flying and gets this cutting. And actually, I was talking to the cook and I know that he kind of went like, you know, we have a few branches, mm-hmm. and then they were deciding what to do with them. You know, like, so we will send to Microtop, and then they could go like, yeah, I can rot that, like this. And then, yeah, he went and rot it, and then everybody else is failed.
Wow.
Micropropagation and all that stuff. So sometimes, I don't know if it happens to you, but sometimes you have this feeling of like, you look at something, and you think like, oh, I think that will rot easy. And sometimes maybe you're wrong, but many of the times, very often, you're right. And you can feel the force. So with this one was about, you know, also, I mean, there are also other factors which helps, like the fact that this plant was flowering every day, like mad. That was something which told me, well, it's not going to be because there is no chances, if you know where I'm going, because if there is one of these plants that flowers maybe one bloom in the pump house, at 50 meters from the ground, sometimes you cannot even see it, and it happens twice in a decade.
Right.
You may want to move into something else. You know, if it happens and you come across and it's flowering, you go and you try it. But it's not something that you can try and try and try and try and try and observe and then start getting the ball rolling.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like maybe you ask yourself a question and may you find an answer, and then that answer opens some other questions. So in this one was, first of all, the thing of like, everybody has given up, now it's my turn, I'm going to try it because I have plenty of chances in front of my face, happening every day, and then take it from there, and then keep going and going and going. And just also the feeling, wouldn't it be amazing if you managed to do it? If you know what I mean, wouldn't it be amazing if this thing now, after 25 years, after all this doom, goes and does it? And the answer for that was always, yes, it would be amazing, isn't it? And then, you know, but for example, one of the things I realized is that, you know, when you observe plants day by day, day by day, day by day, and, you know, the weather changes, and maybe you have one plant in one zone and another one, if you have very good kind of photographic memory, you start realizing things.
Right.
Which perhaps you don't realize the first kind of couple of days you look at the plant.
Right.
You know, like maybe the flowers are beginning winter and they are smaller or they may be greener. And then suddenly I realized that some plants in sunny conditions, which were hotter, the style was elongating. It was like opening towards the end of it. But that moment, there was no pollen left in the plant. So I started transferring pollen from fresher flowers, which the style wasn't doing that, but the anthers have plenty of pollen. And then if you do that like 100 times, you may get a fruit with 5 seeds. Yes. And then the thing, automatically, first we were told that it would be impossible. Doom and gloom coir comes and says, it wouldn't contain seeds. Mm-hmm. And you look at them and you ask like, why? And then they just don't know. It's like you are in this, you know, I sometimes may be part of that coil for other items.
Right.
You know what I mean? Because we are all a little bit like that. But in that case, I was in the side of like, no, if there is a fruit, why are you setting a fruit if you don't have seeds?
Right.
You know what I mean? And then there was seeds. And then, wow. Well, they may not germinate. Oh my God. You know, like you have to go, because once we all have that idea that this cannot happen, mm-hmm. You know, it's funny because while, you know, it wouldn't be very scientific to say that if you deeply believe in something, it's going to happen, that may not be true. But what is really true is that if you don't believe that it's going to happen, it's not going to happen.
Right.
You know, because you wouldn't even try.
Yeah.
So yeah, and that was for me, the minute a fruit started developing, I could see the whole process done already.
Wow.
You know, because the problem was that hurdle. That was the hurdle. You know, once we jump that one, then sooner or later we will get there.
Yeah.
And then yeah, but the thing is, nobody knew what was going to be the outcome, which was part of the assignment. You know, because the plant could be a self-incompatible plant. Mm-hmm. It could be a triploid plant, therefore maybe sterile, because you know, there was a mutation in that particular seedling, it's sterile. Or it could be a plant which was a heterostylous, like the primroses, where you have this pink and tram type of flowers, and you need to have one of each. Oh, nobody knew what's going on, because we only could see one living plant.
Wow.
So we didn't know what was individual genetics of this plant. You know, the plant has many more genes that is expressing.
Yeah, no, totally.
So, and then, you know, I knew that the moment I had seeds, it would be a surprise if, you know, they are not very tricky to germinate generally. And then if you manage to get some of the seedlings, and especially if you have more than one to flower, I knew that then the solution for restoring the fertility of the plant was going to be there. And then the surprise was that I actually have the last male of the species, functional male, mm-hmm. And then there is female clones in the species, which we didn't have any, but we just invented by kind of propagating sexually this male by using the only few hours of fertility in some old flowers that they had.
That's incredible. It's such a remarkable story because, I mean, what I love about it the most is just it comes from being so intimate with these individuals. You know, a lot of times, in ecology, at least, or conservation, we kind of like we overlook the individual and kind of these, and like you said, there's a lot of apocalyptic doom and gloom. It'll never work. There's not enough. But this is the proof of the fact that if you have intimate knowledge and spend time around these individual species, and especially individuals of the species, and then just trying it instead of, you know, resigning to the fact that, oh, it'll never be, why do we waste our time? Good things can happen. And that's where I think a lot of optimism, at least in the context of sharing successful conservation stories, can go a long way, because you never know what's possible until you try it.
Yeah, I absolutely love the story of this plant. And you know, way before I managed to do anything with it, you know, when I arrived, that was one of the things that get me going, you know. Mm. At the point I arrived to this story in this plan, I was already fascinated by what had happened before to it, you know.
Right.
You know, like, it's a very good example, you know, because it was discovered in the 19th century. It was seen like two or three times since then only. That explains why you need to have taxonomy, mm-hmm. because, you know, if somebody hasn't named this thing before, perhaps then the teacher in the island would have assumed that was some kind of weird little plant which somebody planted Because it was actually in the side of a road.
Weird.
Next to the back garden of a house.
Oh, right. Okay.
You know what I mean? So if it wasn't because somebody had described this plant and then somebody listed as a sting, and then in a book it was mentioned and there was a small sketch of how it may look like it. Rubiaceae, 9,000 species, should I consider that this thing in the side of the road is the last specimen of something which hasn't been described before? No. Probably this will be some of the 8,000 Rubiaceae that some widow planted here because it wasn't like in a pristine forest.
Right.
So the first person to save the species was Balfour when he came out of the ship in Rodriguez Island and he thought, oh, that's a different thing, that's new. And then later on, you know, we know that it was collected here and there in different periods and that's why you need Ferrarino specimens, you know, because you can have a track of what was where just by keeping that dry record of that plant. Then it takes 50 years of not collecting for you to be pretty much sure that the plant is extinct.
Mm-hmm.
So 50 years was 1980s. So 2021 they declared it extinct, which probably was the right thing to do because probably, you know, somebody in the island read like this thing has been declared extinct and perhaps the teacher got in the back of his head that this plant could be that one. And like everything in this plant is like, what's the protocol? 50 years that you declare it extinct. Okay, let's wait until 51 and boom, I reappear in the side of the road. You know, how amazing is that? And also because a children, which has no idea, find it. Why? Because the children knows his environment. And then the question was, when you find a plant you haven't seen before,
yeah.
So he probably didn't know the names of hardly any plants around,
uh-huh.
But he knew that that was not your average plant in Rodriguez.
Huh.
Kind of move all the kind of protocolary things of like speaking to the local government and let's take a cutting because automatically, there isn't how, upon discovery, we all want a piece of this plant. So everybody goes and jumps on it.
Hmm.
And then they start cutting bits and pieces and then it has magical properties and, you know, it was used for infinity of diseases and hangovers and used STDs and hangovers.
Hmm.
Then you know that there is going to be a lot of crazy people wanting it and then they build up a fence. So then humans go and jump the fence. So they build up a second fence and then people jump the second fence. So they build up a third fence and they close it at the top. At the point they decide, after the plant was cut to the ground at some point, you know, but luckily it can resprout from like coppicing.
Yeah, yeah.
And they decide to send this plant to us. And then,
wow.
You know, it was put into cultivation. So it was flown in a small plane to Mauritius Island, from Mauritius Island. It went into the cockpit of a this flight, you know, like this guy fly for like what 17 hours from Mauritius with this box, with this cutting from this plant, he kindly agreed to do it. So it's kind of like, thank you very much for all of you. You know what I mean? It's like 10, more than 25 people involved in saving this plant.
Wow.
You know, I kind of like sometimes get kind of like the credit for it, but the truth is, this has been a team effort over the centuries.
Wow.
Of plant geeks interested in this plant and maybe just paying a little bit of their music to it, you know, like from describing it, finding it again, identifying it again, and, you know, declaring it extinct, sending the kid into the forest. It's kind of really amazing and fascinating. And then in Q, it grew, but when you propagated the cuttings, it was flowering and flowering and flowering and flowering and never said it. And then science look at different aspects. You know, they realized then that it wasn't a triploid plant because they look at the DNA. And it's interesting, you know, because people were telling me, oh, there was this scientist saying, this thing will never happen. That is what they were telling to me.
Weird.
But then actually, when you read the paper, it says the total opposite. You know, the guy which wrote the paper, looking more in detail to this species.
Yeah.
He actually concluded that while at the moment it looks absolutely, totally impossible to do this without finding a second plant, and this is highly unlikely, you know, he is the kind of front coming in the lines. You never know if perhaps with development of new technologies or perhaps preceding facts that we have ignored, maybe one day it may happen.
Right.
So it was more kind of like a kind of social negativity around it rather than the proper science or any particular person bringing it down. You know, it's kind of like there is all these individuals saying, yes, yes, yes. And then there is this collective mind saying, oh, no, no. which I found quite interesting. And then when you know, when I got the seats, it was quite interesting because the plant is Ramos Mania Rodriguez. It comes from Rodriguez Island. And my name is Carlos Magdalena Rodriguez. And in Kew, at the beginning, which is when I did this, everybody calls me Carlos Rodriguez because having two names, Jose Carlos and Magdalena Rodriguez, mm-hmm. I think somebody in HR realized, like, oh, name Carlos, surname has to be Rodriguez because Magdalena maybe is a lady's name. And then I was Carlos Rodriguez. Which usually I am not called myself like that. So it was just kind of like, it was like in a movie, if you like. Yeah. And then there was all these guys from the media calling back, you know, because they come, ask you questions, they go back, they start writing the article. And then they go like, hold on a minute. Who the heck was Rodriguez? The island, the plant, or the guy which did it? And then they were calling back, and it's like, actually, the three of them. They were like, really? And he's like, here? So it's all very funny, I think.
Yeah, what an adventure.
Yeah, it was, to me, that is my favorite plant story
ever. Yeah, that's incredible. And it's amazing. Like, and it's so good to hear it. You know, it was a handful, like you said, of people through time caring enough about a plant, which I think, you know, your work in conservation is proof that more, if we just care a little bit more, even just a little bit more, we can do a great service to not only the plants of this planet, but the ecosystems of this planet. Because at the end of the day, you know, when you're thinking of us creating the sixth mass extinction, plants are really at the center of what habitat is and what supports the biosphere and allows all of these charismatic animals to go on surviving. So without understanding plants and working on plant-based conservation efforts, I don't think we're going to get very far. Would you agree with that?
No, totally, totally. I mean, we are starting the house by the roof, you know.
Yeah.
If you want to protect the panda deer, you have to protect the mountains where the bamboo and the rhododendron lives.
Right.
End of the quote. I mean, there is no escape to this. Unless you want to have animals, come in a safari park.
Yeah.
And any kind of remediation, any kind of conservation, it always ends up or begins with a plant bit.
Yeah.
You know, it's quite funny. There is that sentence. I don't know if I will be able to say it in English properly because we have it in Spain, and I always get confused. Like when the trees don't let you see the forest.
Oh yeah, yeah. You can't see the forest for the trees.
You can see the forest from the trees. Yeah.
Yeah.
In Spanish, it's a bit different. The way you say it. It's kind of like when the trees don't allow you to see the forest. It will be the literal translation.
That's the same difference. I mean, same idea, right?
Yeah, same idea, different kind of sentence. So I think in conservation, that sometimes is the case.
Mm.
Or even the other way around, you know, when they look at this kind of countryside, which actually looks nice, but, you know, like, for example, heath in the UK or North Spain usually is the lowest denominator of the maximum degradation of an ecosystem, you know, by farming and all these kind of cattle getting the nutrients out back into the stable from the forest and then setting it on fire and stuff, you impoverish soils.
Yeah.
And then, I mean, there is some biodiversity on it, but actually, you know, we may see like a beautiful landscape when actually it's an ecological catastrophe. So, yeah, it's always related to, I mean, obviously you have a base, which is like the geological substrate where this ecosystem is, and then also the latitude where it is. But then the next differentiation comes in the vegetation because that is going to indicate you what type of animals and what type of ecosystem you're going to have.
Right. No, that's very true.
Yeah. And I found that interesting in the conservation projects. Very often, interestingly, what is missing is the nursery with the people who have the training to grow the plants and start activating the whole project.
That's so true. If every conservation project started with a nursery of some sort, I think we'd be doing a lot better.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
Totally. Well, yeah, and also you see they are such a, you know, you have an nursery that becomes a little bit of a meeting center for these people, which is in this type of thing. There is a lot of volunteers that can come. You can have children then educating them. So you can shot so many birds at a single shot.
Yeah. Yeah. And then on top of that, you know, you get a couple, you know, charismatic plant species that grow really well and maybe aren't as threatened. And then suddenly you can propagate and give people native plants that grow in their area to help support ongoing efforts. And you could see where this could actually build momentum instead of just, you know, throwing money at keeping a panda in a zoo somewhere.
Sometimes it is, yes. Unfortunately, what happens too is that, you know, a panda bearing a zoo is something like Rolling Stone, the Rolling Stones life somewhere. You attract masses of people. Perhaps we have been too emotional and not so rational as we should be with the conservation
problem.
I think plants are key to this, especially when you consider the global warming issue.
Yeah.
Because, okay, there is a fossil fuels side to it, actually quite related to plants, because if you think about it, probably most of the fossil fuels we burn, like coal and most of the petrol and stuff, comes from actually plant ecosystems that got fossilized.
Right.
So that will give an indication of where I'm going now, because the thing seems to me then that the only thing that is fixing carbon from the atmosphere at an amazing rate and producing and storing energy and many other kinds of chemical compounds and substances is called plants.
Yeah.
There is nothing else. You know, everything else goes and releases carbon dioxide, and the balance is not good, including by myself.
We're all guilty.
Dioxide now, and I have a carbon footprint.
Right.
Usually plants, they have a negative carbon footprint. Another big reason why global warming is happening, besides fossil fuels, is deforestation. There you go. There is only two ways of stopping deforestation. One is stopping chopping, another one is planting what has been chopped.
Beautiful.
Another one is, actually, everybody's debating about what we should eat because, the cows produce this carbon dioxide. Well, at the end of the day, every single process of food has a carbon impact. Now, agriculture, which enables you to crop plants without having to till the soils, will be another massive impact into avoiding carbon dioxide. So the plant subject has every single side of it, I think, has a plant either causing it or avoiding it.
Yeah, everything has a botanical solution.
Well, it does. You know, yeah. At the level, it's quite funny. You see, when this film, The Martian, came along, isn't it?
Yeah, no, exactly.
And it's true. You know, it's like this world will stop spinning if it wasn't because horticulture, our human society will stop spinning straight away. It's just that we have become more used to the idea that you press a button and then a machine comes into a field and just sows all the seeds and harvests them. And it's all automatic. But behind all of that, there is a lot of science and there is a lot of knowledge and there is a lot of horticultural techniques.
That is so very true. And, you know, I'm gaining more of an appreciation for that because I've got a lot of colleagues now in agricultural departments, and I don't think the public knows enough about what's going on behind the scenes. Like, as you said, you know, they see the machines and the harvesters. But, I think growing plants is one of the most important skills humanity's ever stumbled upon.
Yeah, yeah. Knowing how to use plants was the main difference between life and death.
Very true. Very true.
And I believe it's still the case. You know, it's just that we don't see it. We are totally plant blind. But you see, but it's breathing over the place. You see, yesterday, talking about the eclipse, the total eclipse in the U.S., somebody was saying about this thing of like maybe a volcano, super volcano eruption could block the sunlight for a few months. And that will be another case scenario in which humanity will disappear, much more likely than being having an impact of a meteor. And then I read the planet is estimated that it has only food reserves for something like 60 days.
Oh, that's scary.
So this is when growing hydroponic plants in dark conditions may become hardly, I don't know. But, you know, there is always a... I don't know. To me, I feel much more safer knowing that there is nearly half a million plant species out there, a lot of people which know how to grow them, than without not having all these resources. You can see it all the time, you know, like, for example, for years and years and decades and almost centuries, we have relied on kinning to treat malaria. Now the kinning tree is almost extinct in the wild, even though it's a main ingredient of gin tonic and it's done now by cultivation, I guess. And when the parasite which creates malaria built up systems, then we were in trouble until the Chinese came up with another plant. Guess what? It wasn't coming from any other source. It was coming from a plant. You know, obviously, something like malaria will mean the death of millions and millions and millions of people throughout the tropics. And in the times of global warming, that not only the tropics.
Oh, exactly.
Many different sites, all the way to almost You know, but in northern countries in the summer.
Yeah, no, I think of like where I work in the summer, you know, parts of the coastal plain in North Carolina, you know, you start getting more and more mild winters, and suddenly these diseases we thought were gone, especially the mosquito vectored illnesses, are suddenly going to come racing back into the picture, and we got to be ready for that.
Yes, you see, I was in Spain this summer, and usually I go to Spain often, but then usually I go to only the area where I am from. And this time I went to another province nearby, and then it's more like central Spain. And I was like shocked. You know, there is this, it's almost like the four horses of the apocalypse, is how you call it. You know, yeah, because they have this beetle, the picudo rojo, which is like a beetle, which destroys palms. And every single palm was dead. Behind a kind of massive death corpse, which will cost you something like 6,000 euros to get paid off. It's starting to attack some native palms in the south. Then there was this small beetle destroying. Suddenly you go in a road and then all the oaks are brown and you go like, oh. And then scary. You think like maybe they're having a drought, and then maybe you see the trees pulls in the side of the road, and then you cannot work out what's happened. And then you look closely to one of them when you stop for a coffee, and then it's full of small beetles destroying it. And it's another kind of invasive species. And then there was this new hornet wasp, which is massive, and that sometimes people die of one or two bites, and it was everywhere, you know, and you see it like pollinating plants and eating bees and eating all sorts of insects, and they were everywhere. And you just go thinking like, oh my God, you know, it's just like the whole ecosystem has been changed as a result of that.
Yeah, it's scary.
Yeah.
So, Carlos, if anyone wants to find out more about your work or hear, you know, understand what you do day to day, how do you recommend they find out more about you?
Well, if that's the case, it's a handy question, because I just published a book in the 1st of June in the UK and Commonwealth called The Plant Messiah.
Ooh, that's exciting.
Yeah, I hope so. and then that is going to be published in the US too. There is a kind of American version coming, in which they change all the English lorries for American trucks.
Wonderful.
And that will be published in April.
Awesome.
It's called The Plant Messiah Travel Adventures in Search of the World's Greatest Species. And it's a little bit of everything, you know, it tells a little bit of my childhood and then how it comes that I came to England and how I managed to enter Cure.
Wonderful.
And then there is this history of the Ramos Mania, and then from Ramos Mania we'll go traveling all over the world. We'll go to Mauritius, we go to Australia, we go to Peru, Bolivia, and we look at different kind of adventures, but also different problems, different solutions, and different characters and different people, which is working in all of this, in the hope that, you know, I can inspire some people to pay more attention to plants. I brought it with intention that, you know, plant people will enjoy it, because there's plenty of plant stories there that they may. And then also to try to initiate more people into this, or to help people to understand why this is all of it really important, interesting, and cool. So yeah, that has been quite a lot of hard work put together. You know, and it's never over, because now I am doing the Spanish translation too. It's coming into Spanish, coming in Dutch, German.
Wow.
And in Chinese.
That's very exciting.
Yes, because, you know, they told me actually that in America they want to do also an audiobook, which I really like for a simple reason. Like, I can even get access to blind people which cannot read. Because at the end of the day, it's about the message, really.
Yeah, that's awesome. I very much look forward to reading that. Well, again, Carlos, it's an honor to have you on the podcast. I've been a fan of your work for a long time, and I really appreciate you taking the time to talk with us today.
Oh, no, thank you very much to you, because I hear it very often, and I really like it.
Well, thank you. That means a lot to me.
No, it is. You know, you always have interesting facts and interesting people talking, and, you know, it's never boring, to be honest. And it's just kind of like the same thing I just discussed now with the book. You know, there is really a need for being publishing information and getting people's stories and getting nice kind of positive things going, so that people get enthused. Because as we discussed at the beginning, nothing gets done without no interest, isn't it?
So true, so true. Well, again, thank you very much, and you have yourself a great rest of the week.
Thank you, same for you.
All right, thanks. Cheers.
Thank you, bye.
The world is a better place with Carlos in it. I would love to shadow him for a few years and just absorb all of his knowledge on plant propagation. It's just incredible, and I really dig his passion, and I'm very much looking forward to that book he's got coming out, The Plant Messiah. I can't think of a better name for that guy. So thank you for listening, everyone. Again, if you want to support this podcast, patreon.com/indefensiveplants, or just go to indefensiveplants.com and click the donate button. At the very least, consider subscribing to and reviewing this podcast. Also, youtube.com/indefensiveplants. Go check out our latest video and see if we find the autumn coral root orchid. All right, everyone. Got some great stuff coming up in the next couple of weeks, so make sure you're hitting subscribe. Other than that, I hope you have a great week. This is Matt signing out. Adios.